Hello, hello. So it seems that my intro did not go out. Have to talk to SMJ about that, I guess. Well, this is another live reading experiment on Hear Now the Words. What am I reading today? Well, I'm going to begin by following up where I left off last time, which is from volume 16 of the Proceedings of the 1955 Geneva Conference on the Peaceful Uses of Atomic Energy. We had just finished with the statement about international cooperation in atomic energy by Mr. Randers of Norway. The president, that is to say, Homi Bhabha of India. Our time is up, but as a special request has been made, I now call upon the last speaker in this discussion, Mr. Henri Mehdi of the Holy See, to make his comments. Mr. Mehdi. The delegation of the Holy See, representing at this conference a spiritual power which unceasingly exhorts men to use the world's God-given resources for the benefit of one and all, through the greatest possible mutual cooperation, would like to emphasize what decisive progress the present conference has made towards the realization of item 24.1 of our agenda, the pursuit of truth, generosity in communicating results obtained, and above all, the conviction that in this field every discovery belongs to all men so that they may use it for their welfare. Such are the distinctive features that have ensured the success of this conference. And they remain the essential conditions for any international cooperation in the peaceful uses of atomic energy. Of course, the terms of reference of our conference did not cover the whole range of the problem. In particular, we still need to study, and to study very closely, the social and economic factors necessary to ensure a fair distribution of our new wealth, so that it may serve, first and foremost, the poorest and materially most underprivileged peoples. We also need a concerted effort to ensure that the upheavals, which the evolution of nuclear science may well bring in its train, respect the natural rhythm of man's life and do not shatter the surest foundations of human dignity. Technology will serve this end only if the fellowship achieved in the pursuit of truth is directed towards that authentic peace which is founded on love among men. This being said, my delegation is thankful that with the help of God, the first step has now been taken along the road to the peaceful use of atomic energy, that first step for which His Holiness the Pope prayed when, some 16 months ago, he visualized the day when we should be able to see the wise men of this world turn their brilliant discoveries of the deep forces of matter to peaceful ends alone, so as to give men cheap power to supplement their scanty resources of wealth and labor, or to correct the uneven geographical distribution of those resources, and so that medicine and agriculture might be given new tools and the people's new sources of prosperity and well-being. The President. I regret that at this point I am compelled to close this discussion because our time is up. Many delegations, including my own, will be disappointed that they will be unable to make their comments on this subject. And then there's a brief gap for another discussion, and then. The President. Before we now come to the final item on the program. Before delivering my closing address, I would like to draw your attention to the messages from the President of the Council of Ministers of the Bulgarian People's Republic and from the President of the Academy of Sciences of Bulgaria, texts of which appear in this morning's journal. These messages were received a few days ago after the beginning of the conference. I'm sad to say, that the text of this journal doesn't seem to have been reprinted anywhere. It would have been a good addition to Volume 16. I would also draw your attention to the note in this morning's journal concerning the credentials of the representatives at the conference, which is included as called for in the rules of procedure. Fellow delegates, this conference started with great hopes and expectations and the good wishes of the great statesman of our time. The eyes of the world were upon it. Now that we have come to the end of our work, we have reason to be pleased with what has been achieved. It is the unanimous view of all concerned that this conference has succeeded beyond all hopes and expectations. A remarkable feature of this conference has been the scientific and objective atmosphere which has prevailed throughout. A calm and objective atmosphere is natural at scientific meetings, but I cannot remember any scientific meeting in which these qualities were more conspicuous. This is all the more remarkable when one considers that the delegates to this conference have come to it as the representatives of their respective countries. This is the largest conference ever organized by the United Nations. No scientific conference of this magnitude and importance has ever been held at any place, at any time. 73 nations have participated, and it has been attended by 1,400 delegates and nearly as many observers from academic institutions and industry. It has been covered by over 900 correspondents. The formidable task of organizing this conference has fallen to the Secretariat of the United Nations, both in New York and in Geneva, and 738 members of its staff have been directly engaged in this operation since its initiation in January. The documentation for this conference alone was a huge problem. 1,067 scientific and technical papers were submitted, all of which will be published in the proceedings. 450 of them have been orally presented during the last fortnight. Some 16,000 pages of documents in one language alone have been printed and distributed. In addition, each document has been or will be translated into four languages. In Geneva alone, over 2 million copies of documents have been distributed. The verbatim records of the conference amount to approximately 3,000 pages, and the entire proceedings of the conference were translated simultaneously in four languages. The translators and interpreters have had a particularly difficult task, as they have had to handle scientific and technical material with which they were unfamiliar. I mention these facts to indicate to you the enormous magnitude of the job which the Secretariat has had to handle. I am sure you would all wish me to express our great appreciation of the work done so successfully and so unobtrusively by the Secretariat. The success of the conference has been due in no small measure to the skill with which the scientific material has been sorted and arranged, and the excellent way in which the programs of the various sessions have been drawn up. We owe a great debt to the Conference Secretary General, his deputy, and their staff of 20 scientific secretaries who have carried out this task. They have identified themselves wholly with the spirit of the United Nations and have done their work with an impartiality and an absence of national bias, which has contributed in no small measure to the success of the conference. Its success is also due to the spirit and the manner in which all the representatives have played their part. From the very beginning, meetings have begun and ended on time, and all the speakers have adhered to the time limits set in the program. I am told that this is by no means a usual feature of international conferences. The difference can perhaps be attributed to the circumstance that in a scientific conference such as this, each speaker has something concrete to communicate. I suppose that when one has nothing concrete to communicate, There is no inherent reason why, having started speaking, one should stop. In my opening address, I drew attention to the importance of atomic energy in the broad perspective of human history and touched briefly on some of the problems which the conference would consider. It would be natural at this point to summarize the conclusions which have emerged in the papers which have been communicated and the discussions which have taken place. Fortunately, this task has been done for me in large measure by Sir John Cockcroft in the excellent evening lecture he delivered yesterday. I will therefore content myself with merely picking out a few highlights. The feasibility of generating electricity by atomic energy has been demonstrated beyond doubt. Indeed, one cannot but be impressed by the very large number of fundamentally different possibilities which lie before us in the design of atomic reactors, and by the boldness and imagination with which some of those possibilities are actually being tried out. As was anticipated, the sessions on reactor technology proved to be some of the most interesting. The economics of atomic power generation have also been greatly clarified. While the capital costs of atomic power stations are still higher, by 50 to 100%, than those of conventional power stations of a comparable size, the fuel costs are very much less, resulting in an estimated cost of between 5 and 7 mils per kilowatt hour of electricity generated by power stations of 100 to 200 megawatts of installed capacity. There are good reasons for expecting that the capital costs will come down during the next decade, thus still further reducing the cost of electricity. Even with present costs, atomic power stations would be economically competitive with power stations of a conventional type in many areas of the world where power costs are high. The capital and operating costs of an actual power reactor in the United States with an installed capacity of about 2,000 kilowatts was given. The cost of power from this small plant worked out at between 30 and 35 mils per kilowatt hour, which is less than double the cost of power produced by coal plants of the same size. It appears that there are many parts of the world where power would be acceptable at this price, and small package power plants of this type may have widespread uses, especially in underdeveloped areas. I wonder how they found comparison figures for a plant like that. I would think that in that size you'd use a diesel engine. Several countries expect atomic energy to make a substantial contribution to their electricity generation during the next two decades. Thus, it is anticipated that nuclear power will provide 40% of the total electric power requirements in the United Kingdom by 1975, replacing the need for 40 million tons of coal per annum. It is likely that in making their plans for future power development, many countries have not yet seriously considered the possibility of using atomic energy because the technical and economic information was not available. One may expect that as a direct result of the information which has been made available in this conference, many countries will review their future power requirements, and this conference may therefore well lead to a very considerable acceleration of the rate at which atomic energy is put to use for power generation in different parts of the world during the next two decades. It came out clearly in the course of the conference that when the development of a widespread atomic power industry takes place, ample supplies of uranium and thorium to feed it will be available. A highlight of the conference was the demonstration of the importance of thorium for the production of atomic energy, and a possibility of a positive gain factor in the conversion of fertile to fissile material in the thorium U-233 system, which was shown to be superior to the uranium-238 plutonium system in several ways. The breeding of atomic fuel in fast neutron reactors also holds out exciting possibilities, on which the prototypes now being built will throw more light in the next few years. Another remarkable feature which the conference brought to light was the parallel work, which has been done in secrecy till now in several countries. For example, no less than five countries had independently developed the same techniques for the extraction of uranium from certain ores, while data on the fission process in uranium-233, uranium-235, and plutonium had been measured independently in France, the United Kingdom, the USSR, and the United States of America, with remarkable agreement among the results. The sessions on biology and medicine have shown the great importance of isotopes in the study of all the phenomena of life. The discussions indicated that all countries were alive to the direct biological hazards of radiation and that safe tolerance doses had been established. On the other hand, the discussion of the genetic effects of radiation clearly showed that we have not yet enough knowledge on which to base definite conclusions, and that a concerted and massive research effort on this problem is required before we can be quite sure that no suffering will be caused to future generations through the production of deleterious mutations. There is no cause for alarm, but till the matter has been fully studied and understood, it would be wise, wherever possible, not to permit people to be subjected to more than about a tenth of the dose considered safe at present. While there is a difference of opinion among scientists on this and several other subjects, it is important to note that the differences showed no national pattern. Credit for the excellent scientific atmosphere is due to the spirit in which the representatives of all countries have participated, but it was clear from the beginning that the scientific and technical contributions of all countries could not be the same. I wish particularly to express our great debt and appreciation to those very few countries most advanced in this field, which have so wholeheartedly and generously placed before this conference the knowledge which they have gained during the last decade through such strenuous efforts and at such great cost. The success of the conference has depended largely on them. This scientific conference, which will inevitably have far-reaching political consequences, differs in one important respect from all political conferences. Knowledge once given cannot be taken back, and in organizing this conference, the nations of the world have taken an irreversible step forward, a step from which there is no retreat. The proceedings of this conference, with all the papers submitted to it, are to be published in four languages as a permanent record of the work that has been done and will cover no less than 16 volumes. Mr. Hammarskjöld, the Secretary General of the United Nations, whose other important duties did not permit him, to his great regret, to attend this conference beyond the first few days, has asked me to convey to you his congratulations on behalf of the United Nations at the achievements of this conference and the gratitude of the organization to all those who have contributed to its success. According to the decision of the General Assembly, the Secretary General will have to report to it on the conference. The Secretary General informs me that in this report he hopes to put forward such practical proposals as seem appropriate in view of the need to follow up the work so well begun at this conference, and in order to equip the United Nations to meet such responsibilities in this field as may grow out of developments during the next session of the General Assembly. He expresses the hope that the Secretary General will be able to count on the continued assistance of the Advisory Committee, whose help in the preparation of this conference has been invaluable. One of the most important contributions of this conference is that in this important field, it has reestablished the channels of communication between men of science in different countries, channels which were interrupted with the outbreak of the Second World War. It has reestablished that free exchange of knowledge among men of science, which is one of the greatest glories of our civilization. It is clear that this exchange of knowledge must continue, and all are universally agreed that after an appropriate period, another conference of this type should be held to continue the work which we have here initiated. I am happy to inform you that I received this morning a message from Mr. Bulganin, chairman of the Council of Ministers of the Soviet Union, which should give us great satisfaction and which I shall now read out. The International Conference on the Peaceful Uses of Atomic Energy, now drawing to its close in Geneva, is a significant step toward the establishment of international cooperation in the most important field of the utilization of atomic energy for peaceful purposes. The exchange of views and information which has taken place at the conference represents a valuable contribution to further scientific and technical progress in this field. This conference will undoubtedly serve the cause of peace and make for a further relaxation of international tension. The Soviet government congratulates all those taking part in the conference on the success achieved and expresses the hope that international cooperation in the field of the peaceful utilization of atomic energy, which has been so successfully inaugurated at this conference, will be continued through the regular convening of similar meetings of scientists from all countries. Chairman of the Council of Ministers of the USSR, N. Bulganin. I am also happy to inform you that I have been informed by Admiral Strauss, the leader of the United States delegation, that he received a message a few days ago from President Eisenhower,
who is highly gratified by the success of the conference, expressing his hope that a second conference will be convened at a later date to continue this great beginning of international cooperation. After the close of this conference, we will all return to our work, which in one way or another is connected with furthering the peaceful applications of atomic energy. We can now do so with the satisfaction that we have in our modest way helped to make this historic conference a success, and with the knowledge and determination that our labors will be directed and used towards bettering the conditions of life for all men, wherever they may be. I now declare this International Conference on the Peaceful Uses of Atomic Energy closed. All right. So I think I'm going to read another one of the evening lectures here. The list is Physical Science and Man's Position, Niels Bohr. High Current Accelerators, Ernest O. Lawrence. Principles of the Acceleration of Charged Particles, Vladimir J. Wechsler. Radioactive Tracers and Their Application, G. de Hevesy. Radiocarbon Dating, Willard F. Libby. Light Mesons, Hans Bethe. Heavy Mesons and Hyperons, Louis Le Prince Ranger. Modification of Radiation Response, Alexander Hollander. Radioactive Elements in the Study of Plant Life, Andrei Kursanov, and The Future of Atomic Energy, Sir John Cockcroft. That last one I read before. Now, some of these, the ones on mesons and hyperons especially, are pretty much of historical interest only. The one on radiocarbon dating is still pretty interesting, but I think that I'm going to start with Radioactive Tracers and Their Application by de Hevesy. The early roots of the method of radioactive tracers, of radioactive indicators, go back to the physics department of the University of Manchester, which was under the inspiring leadership of Lord, then professor, Ernest Rutherford. Quite shortly prior to embarking on studies which led him to his discovery of the nucleus of the atom, Rutherford was greatly interested in the properties of radiation emitted by a number of radioactive bodies, including radium D, and was anxious to obtain a strongly active sample of this radio element. Radium D is a disintegration product of radium emanation of radon and can be obtained from glass tubes in which radium emanation was kept and in which it decayed. Such radon-containing tubes were much used in cancer therapy. A much more abundant source of radium D is the large amounts of lead obtained when purifying uranium ores. In those days, the only uranium mine was that of Joachimsthal in Bohemia, owned by the Imperial Austrian government. The Austrian government showed great generosity toward scientists engaged in the study of radioactivity. It presented Pierre and Marie Curie with a railway carload of pitchblende, enabling them to isolate radium shortly after their discovery of this element. All work carried out with radium by Rutherford and his school had to be done with a radium sample lent by the Austrian government, which also presented Rutherford with many hundreds of kilograms of lead chloride prepared from pitchblende containing the precious radium D, which was useless, however, due to its contamination with very large amounts of lead. One day in 1911, when I met Rutherford in the basement of his institute, where the lead chloride was stored, he addressed me in his usual unconventional way, telling me that if I were worth my salt, I should separate radium D from all that disturbing lead. I was then a young man, they are always optimists, and I did not doubt for a moment that I would succeed. I failed entirely, and had to conclude correspondingly that radium D and lead belong to the group of practically inseparable substances, as such bodies were called prior to the coining of the word isotope, which was of later date. Since my extended separation attempts were a total failure, I tried to find consolation in the possibility of labeling lead by adding pure radium D prepared from emanation tubes to a known amount of lead and tracing the path of lead atoms by means of radioactive measurements. The only institute which in those days handled large numbers of radium emanation. The only institute which in those days handled large amounts of radium emanation, and thus of radium D, was the Vienna Institute of Radium Research. This fact induced me late in 1912 to go to Vienna, where I was fortunate enough to meet Dr. Paneth, an assistant to this institute, who had carried out equally extensive experiments to separate radium-D from lead, and who received the same negative result. We worked together on tracer experiments with radioactive lead and bismuth. Radioactive tracers were for the first time applied early in 1913 to the determination of the solubility of slightly soluble salts as lead sulfide and lead chromate in water, using radium-D as an indicator for lead. These experiments were soon followed by numerous applications of radioactive lead and bismuth isotopes as tracers in the study of problems of inorganic and physical chemistry. A study of the laws of electrochemistry at very low concentrations of lead and bismuth ions was carried out. The interaction of atoms of metallic lead and lead ions contained in a surrounding aqueous solution and the interaction between the ions located in the surface layer of solid salts as lead sulfate and the lead ions of the solution in which they were immersed were investigated. When,
almost a century ago, Maxwell was faced with the task of calculating the rate of diffusion of gaseous oxygen into gaseous nitrogen, he made the assumption, to simplify the calculation, that the size and mass of the nitrogen and oxygen molecules are identical, calculating thus the diffusion rate of oxygen into oxygen, which he called self-diffusion. The possibility of labeling lead enabled us to turn this mathematical fiction into a reality and to measure the self-diffusion, both in liquid and solid metallic lead and lead compounds. Very numerous and extended studies on self-diffusion and diffusion in solids were made in the later years when radioactive isotopes of almost every element became available, and these studies broadened considerably our knowledge of the solid state of matter. A few years later, Paneth, making use of labeled lead and bismuth, discovered the existence of volatile hydrides of these elements and also the existence of free radicals, and in this way made advances of great importance. By means of isotopic indicators, we can trace the paths of atoms and molecules. Since their path is most intricate in living organisms, radioactive tracers have found by far their most extensive applications in life sciences. The first application of radioactive tracers to biology was the study of the uptake of lead ions, labeled by the addition of its radioactive isotope thorium-B, prepared from radiothorium, isolated from thorium-containing minerals. Not only was the path of lead in the plant followed by radioactive measurements, but the extent and the speed at which lead ions are released by the plant when placing it in a culture solution containing inactive lead salts was also studied. Thus, it was possible to distinguish between lead ions taken up by the plant at different times and from different sources. When, a quarter of a century later, radioactive phosphorus became available, such a possibility proved to be of great importance to agriculture. It was now possible, for example, to distinguish between phosphorus taken up by barley from fertilizers added to the soil and from the soil proper. A great number of similar studies have been carried out, and I wish to mention the results obtained by Spinks and his colleagues in Canada. They added phosphorus 32 labeled phosphorus 30 fertilizers, 12 kilograms P2O5 per acre, of different types and of known radioactivity to the soil, and determined both the phosphorus content of the plant and its radioactivity. If, for example, 1 milligram of the plant phosphorus was half as radioactive as 1 milligram of the phosphorus of the added fertilizers, they could conclude that half of the phosphorus of the plant originated from the fertilizer and half had to come from the soil. The results also showed that more than 60% of the phosphorus of barley harvested in June was supplied by the fertilizer and somewhat less of the phosphorus of wheat. When harvesting the barley in August, the share of the fertilizer phosphorus in the total phosphorus of barley was reduced to about 30%. The rate of supply of fertilizer phosphorus declines thus in the later part of the season. While in the early stages of development, the fertilizer supplies the major part of the plant's phosphate requirement, in the later stages, the share of the soil phosphorus in the phosphorus uptake of the plant increases. This is presumably due to the fact that the root system expands with time, and the plant can thus avail itself of an increasing amount of competing soil phosphorus. They further obtained a comparison of the effectivity of different phosphorus compounds as fertilizers. Ammonium phosphate proved to be the most, dicalcium phosphate the least effective compound among those investigated. From the very numerous applications of radioactive tracers in agriculture and botany, I wish to mention just one more, viz. The tracing of the path of the atoms of pollen in fertilized seed. Pollen labeled with P32 can easily be obtained by placing, for example, an aspen branch shortly before pollen formation into water containing radioactive phosphate. The radioactive phosphate diffuses into the branch and participates in the formation of the pollen. Active pollen, emitting several beta particles per microgram, were obtained in experiments carried out in Stockholm after keeping an aspen branch for 7 days in a solution containing 1 millicurie of P32. Even the preformed leaves took up appreciable amounts of phosphorus 32. Female aspen were fertilized with the labeled pollen. The fruits were collected 3 weeks later, and the radioactivity of a known number of seeds compared with that of a known number of pollen. One seed was found to contain the labeled phosphorus atoms of 8 and 9 pollen grains. At first sight, this is a puzzling result, since the formation of a seed requires one fertilizing pollen only, just as, in the animal organism, the fertilization of an egg requires one sperm. However, in the animal organism, not only the atoms of the fertilizing sperm may participate in the formation of the offspring, but also those of many millions more sperms. The very numerous sperms, which did not participate in the fertilizing process, are degraded in the female organism, reach the circulation, and have an opportunity of participating in the formation of the fetus. In a similar way, as the above-mentioned results demonstrate, also atoms of pollen which do not participate in the fertilizing process may contribute to the formation of the seed. The tracing of the path of ancestral atoms through different generations is a fascinating task. A fraction of maternal atoms, varying considerably from element to element, is replaced by atoms taken up by the food and excreted before the offspring is born. Another fraction, though present, may be prevented from taking part in building up the offspring. By applying radioactive tracers, the size of these fractions can be determined. In the extracellular fluid of a human subject weighing 80 kilograms, about 55 grams of sodium circulates. If we administer radioactive sodium of negligible weight, the circulating sodium will be momentarily labeled almost uniformly. We find 4% of the activity administered to be excreted in the course of the first day, and can thus conclude that 4% of all the circulating sodium left the organism as well and was replaced by food sodium. Half of the sodium atoms present at the start of the experiment are lost in the course of about a fortnight. The body contains about 30 grams of cellular sodium as well, and these sodium atoms are preserved longer than the circulating sodium, 10 grams being deeply embedded in the mineral frame of the skeleton and almost quantitatively retained during life. It was the subject of the first investigation carried out in Copenhagen very shortly after Joliot Curie's fundamental discovery of artificial radioactivity to determine if, and to what extent, the atoms of the mineral frame of a fully grown skeleton are replaceable, are renewable. It was found that only a few minutes after introducing labeled phosphate into the circulation, thus labeling the plasma phosphate, P32 is located in the skeleton of the rat. In recent years, the technique of autoradiography has made great advances, and the rapid uptake of P32 by the bone tissue has also been demonstrated by this method. If all skeletal phosphate were replaced by plasma phosphate with time, we ought to find 1 mg of skeletal phosphate to have the same radioactivity as 1 mg of plasma phosphate. This is far from being the case. In experiments in which the radioactivity of the plasma phosphate of the rabbit was kept at a constant level by daily repeated injections, after a lapse of 50 days, the activity of 1 mg of the phosphate of the soft bone reached only 30% of that of the plasma phosphate, and that of the hard bones still less. The results obtained indicating that through the lifetime of the rabbit, not more than about 1/3 of the mineral constituents of the skeleton is accessible to renewal. Similar considerations permit us to determine to what extent the phosphorus atoms incorporated in the numerous phosphorus compounds present in the living organism are replaced, thus the rate of renewal of these types of molecules. The determination of the turnover rate of such compounds was the subject of many hundreds of investigations. While half of the terminal phosphorus atoms of the ATP molecule is renewed in the course of seconds only,
A very slight renewal of the phosphorus atoms incorporated into DNA, present in the nervous system, for example, is observed in the course of a month, the molecules of other phosphorus compounds in the body being renewed at an intermediate rate. In the body, much harassed phosphorus and also other types of atoms find a safe abode in the skeleton only. Some of the mineral constituents of the skeleton, a part of the bone apatite, is dissolved by plasma of lymph, and new apatite is crystallized from these liquid phases. In this process, only a part of the mineral frame is involved, the rest having no opportunity to get into contact with the solvent or not availing itself of this opportunity. Due to this fact, we cannot label a fully grown organism through and through. We can, however, obtain completely labeled animals by administering labeled food to the mother, a procedure which results in the formation of completely labeled offsprings. We fed pregnant mice food containing radioactive calcium, with the result that a litter of mice was obtained which contained, even in their skeleton, labeled calcium only. All members of a litter had about the same calcium content. By sacrificing the different members of the litter shifted after birth to an inactive foster mother at various dates within an interval of a year or two, we obtain information about the percentage of the maternal calcium conserved in the animal during lifetime. Half of the maternal calcium atoms are preserved during the life of the mouse. 99% of the body calcium is present in the skeleton, and a large share of this is to be found in the inaccessible part of the bone apatite. If we continue feeding the litter on radioactive food after birth until it reaches about 100 days and sacrifice different members at different rates, we find that in the course of a year or two, thus almost through life, 33%, that is, one-third of the labeled calcium atoms of the skeleton are lost, the rest being incorporated into inaccessible skeletal parts. Out of the atomic heritage of the mouse, about 1/300 goes over to the offspring, and, as this is the case for each following generation, we arrive at the result that the 11th generation of mice does not contain a single ancestral calcium atom, a result which demonstrates beautifully the known fact that heredity does not involve atomic kinship. While we can locate ancestral calcium atoms in the 10th generation of the mouse, half of the water molecules of the mouse is replaced by water molecules taken up by the animal in the course of 2.5 days, and after the lapse of 159 days, no maternal water molecule is any longer present in the animal. For many years after the discovery of artificial radioactivity, radioactive hydrogen, tritium, was not available, and such experiments were carried out with heavy water as an indicator. Tritium, however, is a much more sensitive tracer than deuterium. We can dilute 1 millimole of tritium 10 to the 12th power times or more and still ascertain its presence, while the presence of a deuterium cannot longer be detected after a 10 to the 6th power times dilution. With tritium-labeled water, the replacement of labeled body water molecules through inactive ones could be followed for a very long time, with the result that, after many days, a 3-day interval does not suffice to replace half of the water molecules of the mouse. This result is to be interpreted in the following way. In the course of the experiment, a minor part of the labeled hydrogen atoms of the water is incorporated at a low rate into organic compounds of the body and is correspondingly released at a low rate in a later phase of the experiment, forming labeled water molecules again. After replacement of most of the labeled water molecules originally present in the body by inactive water molecules, these resurrected water molecules, during resurrection they found a new oxygen partner, make themselves noticeable and are responsible for the fact that 1/100,000th part of the administered tritium is present in the mouse as water even after the lapse of 280 days. That hydrogen atoms of the body water can be incorporated into organic compounds, as, for example, into fatty acids, was already observed in Schönheimer and Rittenberg's classical investigation using deuterium as a tracer. Though deuterium found a most useful application in many studies, the availability of a radioactive hydrogen isotope was a great advance in view of its much greater sensitivity and also because it can be more conveniently determined than deuterium. In early days,
After the discovery of artificial radioactivity, radioactive tracers were prepared under the action of neutrons emitted by mixtures of radium and beryllium. By using 1 gram of radium, a few microcuries of phosphorus-32 of high specific activity, and a few other radioactive isotopes could be prepared. The application of a cyclotron for the same purpose a few years later was an immense advance. From then on, it was possible to obtain 10 to the 5th power times more active preparations than by using neutrons emitted by radium-beryllium mixtures. Also, radioactive isotopes of the great majority of elements became available for tracer work. For those investigators who applied naturally radioactive isotopes as indicators at an early date, the discovery of Frederick and Irene Joliot-Curie opened a fairyland, the size of which was immensely enlarged by Ernest Lawrence's construction of the cyclotron. Not only did the cyclotron prepare radioactive substances of prodigious activities, they were also, with the greatest generosity, put at the disposal of those working with these new tracers by Dr. Ernest Lawrence. The next great advance was the construction of the pile. Radioactive isotopes of almost every element and of prodigious activity became available, among them tritium and carbon-14, which could not formerly be supplied. Radiocarbon found wide application to metabolic and related studies, as well as to dating investigations due to the ingenious discovery of Libby, the results of which he will present. I just want to mention one of these, which, although possibly not the most important, is a very instructive one. Chaikoff and his colleagues injected into the circulation of the rat glucose containing carbon-14 of negligible weight, thus labeling the circulating glucose of the blood. By determining the radioactivity of 1 milligram of glucose secured from the blood at different time intervals, they could follow the speed at which those glucose molecules which had been present at the start of the experiment left the circulation. By collecting the carbon dioxide exhaled and determining its radioactivity, they could furthermore follow the rate at which the carbon of these glucose molecules was converted into CO2. The results showed that half of the glucose molecules present at the start of the experiment was no longer in the circulation after the lapse of 70 minutes. The exhaled air is found to be radioactive a few minutes after injecting labeled glucose. Since more and more of the glucose is being burned, the activity of the air increases for the first three quarter hours, whereafter it declines hand in hand with the radioactivity of the blood. From the data obtained, it follows that 45% of the carbon dioxide exhaled by the rat originate from the burning of glucose, the residual 55% from that of fats and other body constituents. Ions of sodium, potassium, chlorine, phosphate, and so on present in the blood plasma are replaced by extravascular ions at a very much more rapid rate than glucose. Half of the sodium ions present in the plasma leaves the circulation in the course of 1 or 2 minutes. The very great rapidity with which these and also many other types of ions interchange was only revealed when radioactive tracers became available. On the other hand, it takes several days for proteins to be half replaced. Many hundreds of studies deal with the turnover of the constituents of blood plasma. Very beautiful results were obtained in the study of the turnover of the circulating plasma iron, a problem of great importance for medical diagnosis. Usually, minute amounts of iron are taken up from the food. The study of this uptake was immensely facilitated by using radio iron as a tracer. Paul Hahn, Whipple, and their colleagues demonstrated shortly after cyclotron-prepared iron became available that the uptake of iron from the intestinal tract is governed mainly by the iron requirement of the body. Tedious chemical analyses could be replaced by feeding labeled iron and determining after the lapse of several days the radioactivity of red corpuscles in which most of the iron taken up by the body concentrates with time. Later, John Lawrence and his colleagues, and numerous others, studied the rate at which labeled iron atoms present in the plasma leave the circulation and are replaced by others coming from various organs and to a minor extent from the food. Of the about 4 milligrams iron present in the human blood plasma, half is no longer to be found in the circulation after the lapse of 90 minutes.
slightly more than half, plus about 18 milligrams daily, is making its way into the marrow to be utilized for the formation of hemoglobin of the red corpuscles, while the other half is taken up by the liver and other organs. The disappearance rate of the iron atoms from the plasma is accelerated, for example, at high altitudes, where the rate of formation of the red corpuscles is a more rapid one than on sea level. It is depressed in numerous diseases, as in refractory anemia. Lawrence and his colleagues have demonstrated how, with time, the iron atoms present at the start of the experiment are to a very large extent in the red corpuscles of a healthy human, not, however, in that of one suffering from myeloma. A very effective way to interfere with hemoglobin formation, and thus with the path of the circulating plasma iron, is exposure to ionizing radiation. This interferes with the formation of new marrow cells and may destroy even those already present. The milieu in which hemoglobin is laid down being now absent, hemoglobin formation and utilization of iron for this purpose cease. That irradiation interferes with the formation of desoxyribonucleic acid was first demonstrated when radiophosphorus, and later also radiocarbon, were used as tracers. It was also found that this interference is highly specific. Synthesis of proteins, for example, continues in the exposed tissue. When, for example, a marrow cell, in which the formation of other constituents continues after exposure, not, however, that of DNA formation, recovers its synthesizing capacity later on and divides, the division can easily become fatal, leading to the death of the marrow cells. Radioactive tracers can not only be administered to the organism, they can also be produced in situ by exposure to neutrons. The stable arsenium present in the body can, with a comparatively good yield, be turned into radioarsenium. After poisoning with arsenic, an appreciable part of arsenium concentrates in the hair and remains in it. By cutting the hair of a victim of such a poisoning, exposed previously to irradiation with neutrons, and determining whether the hair sample is radioactive or not, we can, as the growth rate of hair is known, determine at which date the poison was administered. In view of the very numerous applications of radioactive isotopes in metabolic and related studies, many of which are highly fascinating, one is tempted to discuss many more of them. I have, however, had to restrict myself to the description of very few examples. Besides the easy availability of radioactive tracers, their very extended application is to a great extent due to the great convenience with which radioactive measurements can be carried out, which compete with the easiest procedures of analytical chemistry. Of all the radioactive tracers, carbon-14 has found the most extended application due to the prodigious efficiency of the U.S., British, and Canadian piles. Many hundreds of labeled carbon compounds are at the disposal of workers in this field. Results of greatest importance for biochemistry and physiology were obtained by using pile-made C14. The most fascinating experiments with C14 were, however, carried out with C14 found in nature, applied by Dr. Libby in his beautiful dating studies, which will be the subject of his lecture. So, the lecture in here is quite interesting, but I don't think I'm going to read it for the simple reason that it's completely dependent on the figures and tables. I'll run through the text later and figure that out. Question from the audience here, from Roters B and Com, about thermonuclear fusion, which I have addressed in some of my previous Step Farther Out shows. He wants to know, you know, what the prospects are for energy production. The answer is not a lot. You see, the problem is, in the 1950s, it was thought that the deuterium-deuterium reaction could be harnessed, but it turns out that its activation energy is higher than we can reliably produce. You can get a much lower activation energy by
by using deuterium-tritium reaction. But tritium is not found in nature. Deuterium is abundant. It's found in all water. Tritium, well, very trace quantities of it are found in nature, but you can't concentrate them to any reasonable effect. The result is that the only supplies of tritium we have, really, are those produced in fission reactors. Now, if we had deuterium-tritium burning fusion reactors today, we would have the greatest difficulty in fueling them because of the scant supply of tritium. Each fusion reaction emits a single 14 million electron volt, that's very high speed, neutron. And this single neutron then has to be used to produce tritium, one atom of tritium, not just to produce one atom of tritium, but a net of one atom of tritium, subtracting all the losses, all the neutrons that escaped without being captured, etc. Now, you do get a certain advantage because when a neutron hits lithium-7, it produces both tritium and another neutron. So you can have a second tritium atom formed there. You do get an advantage there, but it's only a slight one and not enough to count, not enough to make up the deficit of tritium that you're using up, to be quite frank. So if there's hope for useful energy from fusion reactions, it lies in wrapping the fusion reactor with a blanket of uranium, probably depleted uranium. Why? Well, because the fast neutrons emerging from fission are likely to cause uranium-238. The fast neutrons from fusion are fast enough to cause uranium-238 to fission. Fission of uranium-238 occurs to a small extent in fission reactors, but the neutrons from fission only come off at about 1.5 million electron volts. The neutrons from fusion, coming off at 10 times that amount of energy, have a much higher likelihood of causing a fission. And that fission then produces 200 million electron volts of energy, which is absorbed within a very short distance by the blanket. And it also produces 2 to 3 more neutrons, which one of which may or may not cause fission, but all of which will eventually be absorbed in uranium-238 to produce plutonium. Well, what's the use of all that plutonium? The answer is it can then be taken out of this blanket material of uranium-238. And blended with uranium or thorium, or otherwise used in fission reactors. And those fission reactors can then be used to produce enough excess neutrons to produce tritium that you can then feed back into the fusion reactor. Without that, there is really no hope of a fusion energy economy. Now, there is still the possibility of the boron-proton light element fission reaction, in which a proton smacks into a boron-11 nucleus, and the resulting compound nucleus dissolves into 3 helium-4 nuclei. That has the great advantage that the energy comes off as kinetic energy of charged particles purely. In the electrostatic confinement Farnsworth-type machine, in theory, and this is something Robert Bussard worked on for years, and other people have followed him in working on it. In theory, you can then get the energy from the nuclear reaction directly as electricity. You don't have to slow down the particles, take that energy as heat, transfer it to a coolant, boil water, run it through a turbine, turn a generator. You can just use the highly charged grids that are used in the Farnsworth machine to slow down the particles in the electric field and thus generate electric current at about 1 million volts. Anyway, again, that's not what this program time usually is for. This program time is for reading, and so I'm going to pick up again. I have bought several bound volumes of Nuclear Power Magazine. They've got great foldouts and a bunch of stuff, but Nuclear Power Magazine here. And so I'm going to read you actually some of the advertisements. Why advertisements? Well, Mitchell Engineering Limited placed a number of advertisements involving applications of nuclear energy in the British press, and they reprinted these in Nuclear Power so that people in their field could then see what they were doing. How do you like that? And these were done by somebody called Richie Calder. I don't know who he was, actually. I think that the coincidence between his name and that of Calder Hall, the nuclear power plant, is purely coincidence. Anyhow, this one says, "This is one of a series of advertisements by Richie Calder, which is appearing in the national press, to illustrate how atomic power is helping to open up the frozen wastes of the Arctic." And there's a big headline, "Mosquitoes Traced by Radioactive Nectar." People do not usually associate mosquitoes with the frozen north, but Arctic old hands will tell a tenderfoot, "Mosquitoes, they're so big we skewer them on spigots and roast them." This is an exaggeration, but they are certainly man-eaters. Fortunately, they do not, like the mosquitoes of the tropics, like the Anopheles of the tropics, transmit malaria, but when the ice-bound swamps unfreeze in the Arctic summer, they swarm in such vast numbers and bite with such bloodthirsty persistence that the settlers' lives become unbearable. Indeed, it can be said that the mosquitoes are a bigger obstacle to settlement and development of Arctic regions than the cold or the six-month-long night.
Radioactive isotopes. Something will have to be done about these hostile and voracious insects. Already, scientists are hard at work studying their habits. Ingenious methods are being devised to keep track of the swarms, not the least of which enlists the help of nuclear energy. It is known that the mosquitoes drink the nectar of the Arctic poppies. Again, people do not usually associate flowers with the frozen north, and the experts are feeding the poppies with an artificial fertilizer containing radioactive isotopes, which are, of course, byproducts of the release of atomic energy. In the Arctic poppy, then, this radioactive fertilizer finds its way into the nectar. The mosquitoes, sipping the nectar, pick up the radioactive elements, and from there on, they are marked. They carry in their bodies a radio transmitter, and the scientists can follow them wherever they go and find out vital information concerning their habits, information that will lead to their effective control. The end result of using this byproduct of nuclear energy to plot the mosquitoes' activities will help to make the frozen north a more comfortable place in which to live and work, and this, in turn, is an important factor in preparing the way for the time when atomic power itself releases the immense industrial resources of the far north. Mitchell Engineering are designing and constructing nuclear power plants to meet world needs in the new atomic age. Mitchell Engineering Limited, 1 Bedford Square, London. So that's from Nuclear Power for January 1959. Now, I may have enough time for just one more of these ads. If not, well, we'll come back again Friday and test some more of this. Richie Calder's Signposts to the Atomic Age. This is from July of 58. A Harvest for the Desert. In a cave on Mount Carmel in the Holy Land, Dr. Dorothy Garrett unearthed flint sickles set in carved bone candles, proof that 8,000 years ago, men harvested grain. On Mount Hermon to the north, Aronson found the coarse grasses, wild wheat and barley, which these early men had recognized as food. All those thousands of years ago, long before Abraham and the patriarchs, these ancestral men realized the virtues of grain. They nibbled the seeds in the ears. They discovered that from those seeds, more grasses and more seeds grew, that if they scratched the ground, the seeds grew better. And then, if they chose well-watered soil, as in the river valleys, the grains were more plentiful. That, not the domestication of animals for pastoral herding, was the beginning of civilization. When men tilled the ground, they became settlers. Their primitive homesteads grew into villages, villages into towns, and towns into cities. Agriculture led to culture. Grain husbandry spread up the Danube into Central and Western Europe. Rye and oats began their careers as the weeds in the Levantine wheat and barley fields. By climatic selection, they prevailed as the hardy crops of Northern Europe. Bread, grains, and rice are the world's staple food. With the world's multiplying population, we shall have to double the yield in the next 25 years. There are two ways of doing that, by getting bigger crops from existing acreages or by increasing the acreages. The first means better seeds, and the second means overcoming the limiting factors of climate. Okay, I think I clicked off there.